AshevilleFreeMedia@ashevillefm.org. AshevilleFreeMedia@ashevillefm.org. This is the final straw on Embers of Goodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found online at thefinalstrawradio.riseup.net a week after airing, and you can contact us for comments or what have you at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week, we feature a conversation with Candace Falk. Candace is the founder and editor of the Emma Goldman Papers Project in Berkeley, California, and author of, among other things, the biography Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman. While the conversation touches on the life of Emma Goldman, it's mostly a conversation about preserving the history of Emma and the anarchist milieu at her time, and some of the struggles that the EGPP has gone through, as well as its current tenuous existence at the University of California, Berkeley, and what its next steps might be. More on the project can be found online at sunsite.berkeley.edu/Goldman. We're speaking with Dr. Candace Falk. Dr. Falk is the founding editor and director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project, currently at the University of California in Berkeley. Dr. Falk is also the author of Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, among other biographical works on the same subject. Thanks for taking time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So for those listeners who sadly might not know, can you give a brief introduction to who Emma Goldman was?
Emma Goldman was a remarkable woman who lived from 1869 to 1940 and was once described as a person who was 8,000 years ahead of her time. She was an immigrant who came from Russia to the United States when she was really a teenager. And the trajectory of her life is something that wasn't ordinary for immigrants who otherwise would have wanted to fit in more to American culture. She wanted America or the United States to live up to its promise as a place that honored liberty and free speech, and worked all through her life, even after she had left the United States, having been deported for her outspokenness, for those principles that she fought for here. And what's interesting about Emma Goldman is that she became an incredibly articulate spokesperson for the ills of the society and for a vision of a better world. She was an anarchist who believed that beautiful, radiant things and the vision of collaboration and equity among people was possible, and that people needed to reach for that in their lives. And in 1901, in fact, she said to somebody who criticized her for being unrealistic, she said, what I feel, I must speak, not for 100, not for 500 years, perhaps will the principles of anarchy triumph, but what has that got to do with it? Is it right? Not is it hopeless, is the touchstone of courage and principle. And I think that's something that characterizes much of what she did in her life. So she's remembered now for speaking out for women's independence, for sexual freedom, for reorganization of the workplace, for free thinking and free speech, for education that's about critical thinking as opposed to memorization. She actually touched almost everything you can imagine that was sort of au courant in her day. She brought theater, European theater, to the United States in a way that also served the purpose of giving each person a sense of the fact that change can happen internally as well as externally, and that it had to happen that way. And so she loved the theater because it was so personal and individual, but it's the theater that she loved had much higher principles that involved personal courage. She was, in fact, connected to almost every anarchist group in the United States and in Europe, some more than others. She was the editor and director, not director, she was the editor of Mother Earth magazine, which ran from 1906 until just into 1917. It was a voice for her ideas and other people's ideas at a time when it was very difficult to get those ideas out to the people. It was way before internet, way before all the things that we have now, and so the way people got their information was either from lectures or from magazines like hers. It was also a publication that reported on international struggles and situations, especially for the anarchists. And one of the things that I think is the most important about Emma Goldman is that she was a forerunner of free speech in America, that she suffered for speaking her mind, for being eloquent. The government papers that we have at the Emma Goldman Papers repeat over and over and over again that what they feared the most was her eloquence. And her eloquence as a critic and as a person who had a vision of another kind of world. And that eloquence went into speaking against conscription before the U.S. entered the First World War, believing that no government should have the right to force anyone to be in the military. She said that it was part of her principle that if you wanted to fight, you could fight, but if you didn't, you shouldn't be coerced into that. And for speaking out at that moment, just as the U.S. was entering the First World War, when repression was so heavy that even young women and young men who were giving out leaflets for her talks would often end up in jail for 5 years. She was arrested and used as an example of how much the government felt that that was against the interests of a nation that was about to be at war. She went to jail for 18 months, and she was not alone in that. Eugene Debs went to jail, almost all the entire left at that time, unless they were for the war, went to jail. And it was also a period of time when, well, actually all through her life, but especially then, where foreigners, immigrants, were considered suspect, that because the Russian Revolution was taking hold in 1917, those people like Emma Goldman, who looked to Russia at that time as an example of what was possible, although I have to say once she got there, she felt exactly the opposite, but the U.S. was so threatened by that, the government was so threatened by that, that she was part of the first wave of deportations in 1919. She went on to Russia, as I mentioned, to find herself still believing in the revolution, but definitely not in the manner in which it had been proceeding, and was very, very much against Lenin's repression of freedom of expression, among other things, including the concept of horrors. So she eventually left and tried to speak out about what was going on in Russia to most of the left that was enthralled to it at that time. And she, in Europe, in exile, she was kind of a pariah in terms of the left really abandoning her because they felt that she was feeding into these anti-Russian sentiments, and the right wing always hated her. So in that, you can see that she was an incredibly independent thinker. And in many ways, a lot of what she came to think and actually suffered for are the very things we value about her and those ideas now. And it was, she spent some of the time in Europe writing her autobiography, Living My Life, which still stands as an incredibly powerful piece of literature that's not just about Emma Goldman, but really about the excitement of being part of a movement for change. And it was her hope that it would keep that history alive when and not allow it to be deported. And I think she had some idea that maybe it would bring her back to the United States in some way, which it did to some extent, because Eleanor Roosevelt read her autobiography in 1934. The autobiography came out in 1931, and by 1934 she was allowed back to the United States for 3 months. And it was a very changed United States, where many of the things she stood for were actually in action. She actually didn't criticize Roosevelt very much. She was very much in favor of his labor stance. But she had to go back and live in Canada and in Europe and France and England. And it was not until the Spanish Civil War, where she became the representative of the CNT-SAI, the Chintify, the labor anarchists of the Civil War period, that she was re-inspired by what she saw was possible. And by that time, people saw her as the grandmother of the revolution. And she ended up dying in Canada, raising money for the women and children refugees of the Spanish situation, loss, and helping other people who were just starting to feel the repression of the oncoming Second World War in the air. So what's interesting, there are so many things that I think are interesting about Emma Goldman, but one of them is that her 70-year life span is so much history, and she was so much a part of it, and in a way that was not ordinary. And once again, she was an immigrant, she was Jewish, she was a woman, she was an anarchist. She was all the things that might otherwise have put her in a position of being completely, well, she was locked away, but completely terrifying figure. And there are various things that she was associated with which would support that. In terms of her closeness to Alexander Berkman and his attempt at shooting Frick after workers and strikers were attacked at the Homestead strike. I mean, I can go into all the details, but the essence of it is that she was such a fiery figure and so incredibly inspiring and forceful that she couldn't be ignored. And it's very interesting for me to be working on her now, preserving her letters and speeches and newspaper clips about her and government surveillance and trial transcripts, that you see that those issues are remain relevant today. And that is both makes the work very interesting, but it also is a little depressing that the same kinds of things, that many of the same kinds of issues that were critical in her day still plague us today.
How is it that you came across Emma Goldman as a historical character and as an activist and a revolutionist?
I am what my daughter often calls a 70s mom feminist. And when I was young, I lived in Chicago, went to University of Chicago, and really found that there were no female models. The feminist movement was just taking hold. I wasn't happy with the just being women. I had a sort of a larger vision of freedom that included other people, men, and sort of gender trajectory that would encompass all of us. And Emma Goldman's autobiography was reissued at that point. And all of us who were activists read it in our spare time, and we passed it from person to person. It was sort of almost like contraband while you were at school to be reading something else like that, especially at University of Chicago. And I was just incredibly inspired by her as a woman, and also because the image of radicals at that time, the historical image of radicals, were like these very one-dimensional, sleep-on-the-floor kind of people, very aesthetic. And here was Emma Goldman, who believed in beauty and in love and in ecstasy and community. And, you know, even though some of the characterizations of the other people are probably wrong, I still had them. And so Emma Goldman represented a very different kind of combination of the love generation and the political anti-war and freedom, sexual freedom, and more. So I named my Red Irish Setter Golden Retriever Emma. And the reason why I mention that is that in I think it was 1975, but when I was in my 20s, I was teaching also at an institute called Sagaris, which was the double-edged sword of the Amazon. And it was a summer institute that was intended to bring all these women's representatives of women's groups from all over the country to study and think together and to try to make sure that the advances that we had made in our thinking were not co-opted by the university. And I brought my dog, Red Emma, and on my way back from Vermont, where this Sims Institute was, I drove with a friend of mine, who's now my partner in life, he is, and we drove through Chicago. And we stopped at a guitar shop where I had a friend who worked, and my dog, Emma, instead of staying at the door, anarchist dog that she was, she bounded in right after me and knocked over like so many music stands, and I felt horrible, and I spent quite a bit of time trying to lift them up. And at the same time, my friend who worked there said, well, what a lovely dog you have. What's your name? And I said, Emma. Red Emma Goldman. And he looked at me in the kind of quizzical way, and he said, this is going to sound strange, but 5 years ago in the back of the shop, I think I saw some letters from Emma Goldman, and just waited. And he came out shortly afterwards from a storage room with a box, a huge boot box, shoe boot box, full of letters from Emma Goldman to her lover and manager, Ben Reitman. And I have to say that I, for all the education that I had had in my life, I had never seen an original letter. I had not ever seen Emma's handwriting even, which in itself was quite interesting and fun. He was a very sweet guy, and he sent me and my friend to Xerox the letters if we wanted to, and that was so exciting, and I started to Xerox the letters and started to feel incredibly embarrassed because I suddenly realized that these were love letters that I had never known about, and I knew from Emma Goldman's autobiography that she had said that one thing she said is that Ben was the most passionate of all the relationships she'd ever had in her life. And I remember that she had said, his letters were like a narcotic to me. They made my heart beat faster, but they put my brain to sleep.
The full conversation with Candace, including fun stories about Emma's letters, can be found on the show's blog entry for this episode at ashevillefm.org/the-final-straw. Back to our conversation with Candace Falk, main editor and founder of the Emma Goldman Papers Project in Berkeley, California. So you've listed off a few things that have specifically come out of the project, such as the microfilm, the I think you said 36 reels of microfilm, at least
69 reels.
Dang.
Of microfilm.
Okay.
Woo! 22,000 documents.
and just all of the interactions that have come out of it, the three already published and the fourth upcoming editions of the documentary histories, and you've mentioned also the like high school curriculums. Can you talk about the internet portal and what kind of stuff's available on there? Also, like the physical space of the archives.
If you go to our website, which essentially is sunsite.berkeley.edu/Goldman. Lots of different ways into it, but that's one. Or just go online, look for the Emma Goldman Papers. You'll see that our website was one of the very, very first websites put together years ago. We actually won 3 or 4 different awards for its ease of use and communication. I say that with a bit of irony because we haven't really had the money or the staff to be able to upgrade it, but the content of it is wonderful. It's not at all the whole collection, but we tried very much to give an overview of the project. We have our 725-page guide to the microfilm on our site, which enables people to look up, you know, to see if, well, are there letters from Kropotkin? Are there letters, you know, from Kate Richards O'Hare or something? And you can see that there, including many people come because their relatives were somehow connected. We also have some sample documents, and we have 2 of the 3 curricula online, and they're just great in terms of if you're a high school teacher or even community college. It breaks into different sections. so that if you don't have to have an entire course on Emma Goldman that you can fit it into the social studies curricula. So on free speech or on sexuality and women's rights and art and literature. So the only thing about those is that when we did those curricula, it was truly a different time. And so when we talk about censorship and music, it mentions Two Live Crew.
That does kind of date it, yeah.
Various other bands that nobody knows anymore. Really slightly irrelevant. So, but you get the idea. And hopefully if we have the person power and the perseverance, we'll be able to make it more interactional and updated. But in the meantime, the essence is there. And there really are, there's a lot on our website, including some of the articles that came out about our project. And also we posted the pictures that we have and the narrative for our exhibition that can travel all around. It has been traveling around the country. Some reproductive rights and free speech.
It's also really cool that you have examples of like, there's a little bit of the scanned manuscript for Living My Life. There's a bunch of the letters that are actually scanned so you can see what the handwriting looks like, whether it be Emma's writing or Sasha or another Gamo Posada, you know, like you're someone else that's being written with. It's
right.
Fascinating.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that's right. Better said. And we're hoping that once the entire microfilm is online, that will be amazing. But in the meantime, this is kind of a way to take it in without being completely overwhelmed.
What is the actual relationship between the university and the Emma Goldman Papers Project?
It's very tenuous right now. It's a very interesting thing because having a project like ours based at a university, like University of California, Berkeley, gives you access to an incredible library and many, many resources. Incredible students who are just like regular people. It's not a private school, so it has a range of students from all different backgrounds, and access to grants, which is really good. However, when I was recruited, literally, to apply to be the editor of the Emma Goldman Papers, I wasn't on the faculty, and I was actually still finishing Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman. And I needed a faculty advisor to be my link. At that time, it was Arlie Hochschild who did that, quite a wonderful sociologist of women in work. And that's how it started, and I didn't have money from the university. But I did have a place. I had an office, access, and any money that we raised went through the university. And so it seemed like we were part of the university, but we raised our own money. But it, after a while, like almost 10 years of that, there was a vice chancellor for research who really understood how hard it was for us to keep going. And we had employed so many grad students and undergrads in our work that they were quite appreciative. And they gave us parity with the Mark Twain Papers, which is on campus as well and in the Bancroft Library. So during this lovely period of time, maybe 8 or 10 years, we had the university paid for our office, my salary and the salary of an assistant and supplies and things like that. So we felt much more a part of the university. Okay, now here's the rub. When that vice chancellor left, or was whatever, he was no longer the vice chancellor for research, the new vice chancellor for research didn't understand why the Emma Goldman Papers was under their wing and was very suspicious of the work we did. And often we would, you know, we were just having such a hard time piecing things together that they started to watch us like hawks, as if we were dishonest or something, which we were never dishonest. And when it came time to raise money for the project, which we do every year, we send out these wonderful cards where we try to share some of what we have in the archive, along with a greeting to people and a call for help on any level. The Vice Chancellor for Research asked me to send him my letter that I was going to send out to the public. I had never been asked I'd never been overseen on that level. I couldn't even understand why he was asking for it, but I faxed him at that time. That's what you did. I faxed him my letter, and he and it was just before the war in Iraq in 2001, the next second war in Iraq, and everything was getting kind of creepy about, kind of tenuous. People were very nervous about speaking out, and I had two quotes from Emma Goldman that I was using. One was from 1901, which warned, I think it was 1902, it was warned freeborn Americans that repression was on its way and that they might soon understand what immigrants faced all the time of being afraid that their neighbors would hear what they had to say. And the other quote was from 1915, which was, you know, 2 years before the U.S. entered the war, the First World War. And it was Emma speaking out, saying how important it was to speak out against war before the bloodshed that would ensue. And the Vice Chancellor for Research, his name is Bob Price, and he worked with this person, Beth Burnside, crossed out those two quotes. And then I wrote back to them, him, and I said, why did you do that? And they wrote back and said, because it sounds too much like it's against the war in Iraq.
Emma, reading the gold Emma. Crystal ball, right. Specifically right. Addressing the Bush administration. That's so ridiculous.
Exactly. It's so terrible. So I was so upset about it, and like the idea that they wouldn't let me do it. Like, it's always one thing to censor Emma Goldman in her time, another thing in our time. I was just so upset. And by that time, that office had pulled back their funding of us as well. And so we really needed to reach out. And so essentially what happened is that I talked to everybody I knew. I said, what should I do? And I decided that what I would do is pay for the mailing myself, which was no small thing. And so the university couldn't say I used university money for that. And then there were these lovely young people who lived downstairs from me who were graphic designers, and they made a little, sort of like a little folding leaflet that you could put on your desk that had both quotes on, you know, one on each side with Emma's profile on each side in black. And so I decided I could include that in the letter because I could include it as an insert. So, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, mischievous of me because I thought, therefore, it wasn't actually in the letter. So this story got picked up by the New York Times, and it was kind of an odd thing because, you know, actually people in my office said, we really didn't know what to do about it because people in my office actually, some of them don't talk to mainstream press people. Some, you know, there was a whole discussion. And so I became the representative of the project around this issue. And sure enough, on the front page of the New York Times, this reporter, who was quite amazing, wrote that Free Speech University, afraid of words from long ago.
And Mario Savio was rolling around in the ground, right?
In the ground, yeah. You know. And as a little footnote to your comment about Mario Savio, I just want to tell you that we just had the 50th anniversary of Mario Savio's and free speech movement here, and a very forward-looking new chancellor who somehow didn't want to risk linking all of that to the Emma Goldman papers and helping us. I think he's, you know, it's not easy to come into an administration where other people hate the people who link the Emma Goldman papers. The good part was that many, many people sent us money from all over because they believed that we were right. I mean, it was like the best fundraising ever. And people I didn't reprimanding him for not allowing this. And that vice chancellor is still there. And they are unbelievable in the way that they treat us. For example, during the summer, right after that, they tried to fire me by saying that they should, that I had to reduce my time to such an extent that I wouldn't get any health benefits or anything. And so I had to call a lawyer, call them, and say, do you want to be on the front page of the New York Times again? They had said, well, we don't care. We can keep her in grievance for years. So, you know, it's just in this really awkward relationship right now. And so for a long time, I money from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission. On and off, we have money from the National Endowment for the Humanities. But, you know, mostly it's people sending us, like, most people send us $100. There's one person who has been able to send us $25,000. There are many, 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 many tattooed, pierced $5 people on their list, which are wonderful, actually. Like, we feel like, oh, now we're like a community project in that sense. However, it's really hard to stay afloat. We're in an off-campus office, and we pay the rent, utilities, just everything we have to raise ourselves. So even though it all goes through the university, and therefore everybody gets a tax write-off, it's a very, very bizarre situation to be in. We're looking around everywhere for another archive that might be able to take our archive, the full archive, when we're finished. So, you know, so, like, for example, I keep getting, as our funding gets lower and lower, I get more and more termination letters. So I got one in August just after I returned from Washington and received an award from the Society of American Archivists for excellence in scholarship and public outreach of an archive and creating an archive. And I came back to a termination letter that gave us it 60 days. We have so much information that's not just Emma Goldman. That really belongs. It belongs to everybody, and it will create a basis for thinking and scholarship and for, you know, and for just reflection. And the other thing is I want to publish Volume 4, which is 1917 to 1919, as I mentioned before, just as the U.S. entered the First World War. I want to publish it before the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entrance into the First World War, which would be before 2017, because I feel like these 100th anniversary kinds of things, actually, people might read it.
I wonder if you couldn't argue with, since universities seem such fickle institutions in terms of how it can just shift according to who the chancellor is or who the deans are of what departments, how things decide, you know, how things are getting funding from the state government, the political mm-hmm. climate. Like, I wonder if you couldn't just make, and I'm sure you've thought of this, but like make an argument to the San Francisco public library system and say that like one of these branches should open up space to house the archive on the grounds that like during publication of Mother Earth and while the blast was also being published, there was a documentation of a very important and changing time within San Francisco's history. So this is a part of not just New York, not just Chicago, but like American history at that period. And maybe it wouldn't be so, it wouldn't be such a shifting change of tides circumstances as it is with universities, do you think? Or have you tried engaging?
No, I think
engaging?
That's a very, very good point. And I have to say, I wish I had talked to you before.
I mean, I'm not proposing to say anything about a 35-year-old project.
Well, what I think is you're totally right, and I didn't get it. I didn't get that research archives at universities mostly value things that are only the original paper, you know, so that our archive is actually a secondary archive, meaning that we've gone to over 1,000 archives and private collections to find copies of the originals and everything. So that was another reason that they didn't value our collection, and I honestly didn't understand it. And I think you're completely right. And often it's a question of space and people who can curate such collections. And the advantage of ours is that it's already curated because we've been doing it for 35 years. But just literally in January when I was in New York at the American Historical Association, I had an opportunity to talk to the president of the New York Public Library, who invited me to meet with some of the people there, and they expressed their frustration that when people come to their library looking for the Emma Goldman papers, all they can give them is our microfilm. And as he said, our 725-page guide, and actually it wasn't the president who said that, it was one of his staff. So they did express some interest.
That's great. That's a huge library system.
So excited. And I was thinking about, but I don't know what's going to happen. Like, everyone I know who's ever worked with archives is, like, giving their archives someplace, or is, they all tell me it's very complicated. So I'm not exactly sure what that means. I think it's okay to say that they were very open and said that Emma belongs to New York. So I'm hopeful that something like that will happen. I truly wish that we had had that while we were here at Cal. What I gathered from the meeting at the American Historical Association was a panel on the future of the research library, and it seemed like there was a huge controversy in New York about where the books will be. Will they be right in the library, or will they be off-site? And will a library turn into a internet hub or a place for, gala events. And so, I don't know, when they spoke to me, I thought how wonderful it would be if they had collections like ours. These papers projects are treasure troves that, interestingly enough, truly fall between the cracks, because historians don't always get what you're doing. Like, they kind of think you're just putting paper together, or you're not really one of them, or I don't know how to explain it, but there's definitely a caste system, and we're down there. And then archivists really love getting huge rooms full of boxes that are disorganized and making sense of them and feeling like they are part of making the historical record. And that's so similar, but it's also different from the kind of things that we do, where we also do so much background research on who the people are, and I guess some archivists do that, but like what the movements were and what the journals were, and and making sure to fill in. Like, for example, there are people who come to the Emma Goldman Papers just to see, like, there's one person who came from Mexico to see Regeneracion because he couldn't find it. Oh. We had all of it in our project. And, we've pieced together all of the blast, of course. But there are many, many other papers where once we realized that there were so few places that had full runs, every time we had an opportunity to copy them, we do it. So, it may not be Emma, but, we've got it.
Also, but it was contemporary, and it was overlapping, and I'm sure that Emma shared letters with, with the authors and contributors to those journals, too. So
absolutely, absolutely. And that's how we started to collect them, and then we thought, do the other. The other thing that's been fascinating about the Emma Goldman Papers is that in our international search, because clearly Emma, as you know, was an international figure, we had amazing correspondence with many people in different countries in their own languages. And in China, Ba Jin, who was the head of the Chinese Writers Union, who dedicated one of his books to Emma Goldman, we had somebody interview him and send us a letter, and another one of his associates wrote up their memories of being in Paris together. And it's just quite remarkable, the people who we've been in contact with, who were no longer alive. The Chinese material came to us in a pillowcase because they didn't have a way to send it to us. So it was somebody sewed it like an envelope in a pillowcase. And when we got the material from Russia, came in a blue envelope, and they were photographs of documents that included Emma, including the document in which she represented the anarchists and presented their demands to Lenin, who thought that free speech was a bourgeois prejudice. But so we have so much material that's kind of, magical sounds silly, doesn't it? But it's really of unexpected interest. And I always hope that somebody will work on those. I know that the material we have from Spain, for example, there are so many different factions who not only fought against each other during that 1936 to 1938 time, but, for a long time afterwards were very possessive about their archives. And somehow the Emma Goldman Papers were able to get copies of anything we wanted at that time because it was Emma. It wasn't anything in particular that would overlap with a organization trying to take it from the other, I guess.
It was a shared grandmother.
Right. The other thing is, in Paris, we had an experience where we had the police records on Emma, the prefecture, the police, and they were really interesting surveillance documents on Emma when she was in France, and early and later, and we got copies of them, and then it turned out that it either disappeared or they were taken out of circulation. So the only copy we know of is the one that we have on our microfilm. And then there were archivists who told us that the only reason, there were people in, who told us the only reason they gave us full runs of some copies of material in their collections is that they had a hard time, that there was a whole period of time when they said that those materials were often stolen. So for whatever it is, we have preserved them. I know there are lots of fun stories to tell.
Thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation, and I really hope that people check out the website, and if they're in the Bay Area, they get to check out the actual, meet you and check out the actual archives. Maybe they'll be in town for the North American Anarchist Studies Network conference that's coming up in March.
Yeah, we were thinking of having maybe even a tour of our archives at that point. Very early on, there were many people who didn't understand the Emma Goldman papers in our collection period. And so they thought that because I signed agreements with archives all over the world, that I wouldn't replace them, that I wouldn't bring the material out into the public until we had it completely labeled and perfectly referenced to the archive that had the original. A lot of people thought that during that time I had Emma Goldman's letters in jail. And like some people even tried to break into our office because they thought they wanted to free the Emma Goldman papers as if we were keeping them under lock and key. And we always let people, like we always told people where the originals were, but it took us a while to fulfill our obligation to the archives to do it in the way that they asked us to so that they would be available forever. And I think early on, I was very young, and I was very hurt by that presumption that we were doing something wrong when, in fact, we were trying to preserve them. So I have to say I'm very grateful to the young anarchists now who are just so spirited and don't seem to have that edge to them. And I hope that our archive serves them as well as other people. And that the early shadows somehow fade away.
Well, you don't need to worry that young anarchists are always going to find a way to make drama and have infighting and mistake what someone has said.
Was before. Those people who were critical of me are like old now. Some of them have retired. It's like, I don't know.
Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. Asheville for Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw on Embers of Goodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found online at thefinalstrawradio.riseup.net a week after airing, and you can contact us for comments or what have you at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.